Turning now to the second book of Kings, chapter 4 and verse 1. 2 Kings, chapter 4, verse 1. Now there cried a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets unto Elisha, saying, Thy servant, my husband, is dead, and thou knowest that thy servant did fear the Lord, and the creditor is come to take unto him my two sons to be bondmen. Well, our subject is spiritual lessons from the life of Elijah, and particularly from this fourth chapter of 2 Kings, miracles for God's servants. Here are miracles for God's people, God's faithful, those who serve him. And there were some wonderful lessons and spiritual illustrations for us here. But how cruel at the beginning of the chapter. The creditor of one of the wives of the prophets who had died, sons of the prophets, the trainee prophets, well, the creditor wanted her out of her home and wanted her sons into slavery. How indifferent the people had become. It's not so long since they were crying, God, the Lord, he is God, he is God, at Mount Carmel. Moved and affected just momentarily by the triumph of Elijah, Elisha's predecessor. But they've soon fallen away from that. The famine had ended, the rains had come, they had been uplifted as a nation, and yet they went straight back to the worship of Baal. And up in Israel, in the northern kingdom, the prophets were largely in poverty. They were not supported by the people. They had to grow and fend for themselves. They went about doing their ministry, but they certainly had very little support in the land. There were no priests. There were no Levites. They were all down in Judah. They weren't up in the northern kingdom, which was apostate, and they had therefore this ministry of prophets currently under the leadership of the great Elisha. But what poverty and what hardship. And the law of God specifically said and distinctly said in Deuteronomy chapter 15 that if anyone was destitute, then they were to be supported. And those who they owed money to were, as far as possible, to continue to lend it to them and not to harass them. There was to be great compassion in Israel. But there was such cruelty. They not only failed to support the ministry of the prophets, but this kind of incident would take place. So that's the introduction to the passage. A widow of a prophet with two youngish sons in dire need. And in verse 2, Elisha said unto her, What shall I do for thee? Tell me, what hast thou in the house? And she said, Thine handmaid hath not anything in the house save a pot of oil. And Elisha is going to, by the power of God, bring about a miracle very similar to one wrought by Elijah before him. And there'll be another similar miracle also in this chapter. And that's because, among other things, God is saying that this is his handiwork. And it is the same God working through successive prophets. So there are similar miracles. Some people have said, oh, it undermines the record. It's as though the record lacks originality and flair. And some fictitious author is creating similar events and working similar miracles in the hands of successive prophets. Well, they're never identical, but there are similarities, it's true. But that only indicates that it is God stamping them as his work, his doing, his characteristic handiwork is upon them. Well, here's the instruction of Elisha, and here's how she's going to be helped. Verse 3, Then he said, Go borrow thee vessels abroad of all thy neighbours, even empty vessels, borrow not a few, borrow very many. I have no idea the size of these vessels, but they're far more than just flasks. They're obviously fairly considerable. And her neighbours, equally poor, though they can't help her, they certainly trust her. Because if the land as a whole won't support the prophets, Certainly the neighbours of this woman knew well that the husband was a godly man, and she has obviously been very helpful to everyone around her, and she seems to have no difficulty in borrowing these large pots from any number of neighbours. He himself, well, the widow says to Elisha, "Thy servant, my husband, is dead." He worked under Elisha. Elisha knew him. "And thou knowest that thy servant did fear the Lord." So he was a prophet who had tremendous reverence and respect for the things of God and stood very nobly in that ministry and in that tradition. Well, the woman goes out and she borrows these vessels. Here's the instruction of Elisha, verse 4, "And when thou art come in, thou shalt shut the door upon thee and upon thy sons, and shalt pour out into all those vessels, and thou shalt set aside that which is full." It's to be a private miracle. The unbelieving neighbours, however helpful they may have been, they may be extremely curious, whatever is this about, whatever is going to come about for this very poor woman, who even now is being threatened by the landlord or whoever the creditor was, still they're not to be allowed in to witness this. This is a private miracle for a servant of God. And there's good reason for that, because these neighbours to whom she witnesses, and she seeks to win them to true personal faith and piety, they're not to be given wrong motives. Oh, if this lady, this widow, can be enriched by miracle, well then we will. We'll come, we'll worship the true God. We'll return to proper conduct and worship and piety. But their motive will be wrong. It will be simply for gain, simply for support and security and things of that kind. So they're left out. Miracles can be pretty dangerous things. There was a young man came to this church some years ago, and he was Chinese, and he worked in the sweatshop kitchens of Soho. He could do no other, because he'd come in on the back of a truck with an organized gang arranging it all and so on. And he'd reported to the police, the Home Office, told the interviewers a completely phony story about what brought him here. And then it so happened, he was brought by somebody into the tabernacle, and he heard the gospel and he was saved. Now, as a saved young man, he couldn't very well change his story with the Home Office. Because if you say to the Home Office, "Well, I lied when I came in, and now this is the truth about me, can I stay a little longer?" They'll say, "Out you go. You were not truthful." So the crook can find it easier to stay than the person who's been converted and who is honest. And he realized that. So he'd have to go home. And after a certain period of time, he went home. He'd grown in grace. And the reason I'm telling you this is he went back to a particular part of China where there had been a great fuss made by certain writers, authors, about a wonderful conversion in that area, a wonderful revival, and many people converted. Well, now, I've no doubt that this has happened in many parts of China, and I've no doubt that the Lord has been wonderfully at work, and in many of the underground churches there have been tremendous work of God. But it wasn't true, evidently, of this particular place, where this young man found, to his grief and distress, that all the people who were supposedly converted had only gone to get to church to get healing for themselves or for a friend or someone else. They were after something. Well, that's all they wanted, help and a better life and healing of illness and so on. And he found, his experience was, there's very little true faith, very few real converts, true believers. So miracles can be very dangerous. People come in for the wrong reasons, for the wrong motives. So we're not at all surprised that here you've got a miracle to help a child of God, to bring compassion and relief to this widow of a prophet, but she's got to close the doors. It's got to be private. It'll ruin her testimony if people know what's going on, that all her debts are going to be solved by a miracle of God, and create quite wrong motives. This is something the charismatic movement never understands, that you draw people in with all sorts of exaggerated stories and wonderful possibilities, And they come in, but how many, on hearing the gospel, are really converted? Because the whole arrangement is wrong, and the motives are wrong. So I mention that in passing. It's a private miracle. Verse 4, "And when thou art come in, thou shalt shut the door upon thee and upon thy sons." So verse 5, she complies. This lady has great faith. She doesn't say, "But whatever am I going to say to my neighbours?" They say, "What do you want with them? You're desperate. You haven't got any materials to cook. You're on the border of starvation. We've been helping you with bits and pieces. What are you going to do with all those pots? It'll be too embarrassing. I can't do it." No, she obeys. Somehow she overcomes those difficulties, and she begins to pour. And verse 6, "It came to pass, when the vessels were full, that she said unto her son, or one of them, Bring me yet a vessel. And he said unto her, There is not a vessel more, and the oil stayed. Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, Go, sell the oil." It must have been a very, very good quality of oil. "And pay thy debt, and live thou and thy children on the rest." And that's the miracle of provision for this lady. She obeyed, she exercised faith. Well, there are many lessons to be drawn from this. One that the old writers used to love to make out of this is that these vessels had to be empty. And although this is a kind of incidental spiritual picture, it's an important one for us. And we, in seeking blessing from the Lord, instrumentality, conversions in our church, blessings from our Sunday school class, blessing in life and sustaining grace and power, we had better be empty if we wish to be filled and helped by the strength of the Lord. The trouble is, so often we're not. Our vessel is not empty. Our mind and heart is filled with trivia, even of Christians sometimes, and sometimes this world, and sometimes earthly requirements and things. And if we're full of that, we can't be blessed by the help of the Lord. Real emptiness is a great desire for God's blessing, a great concern for lost souls, and prayers that are made out of desire, concern, and a sense of deep neediness. These are the prayers that are answered. But this is a miracle overall of compassion. The people of God are people of compassion. And Elisha leads the way, and he provides a great demonstration of provision for a needy widow who's a believer, an earnest servant of the Lord. And that teaches us the kingdom of God is a fellowship of compassion and concern, a fellowship of care, and we're to reflect that. And this is one of the great examples. And there's another thing here. What a wonderful miracle, an amazing thing. And it reminds us that all the power of God is available for the comfort and help even of a relatively obscure person. Now, the worldly mindset might say, well, the prophet's dead. The man who mattered is dead. This is only his wife. She only cared for him and the family. Now he's off the scene. We won't keep her on the payroll or watch over her or look after her. That might be an earthly mindset, but in the kingdom of God, look, a wonderful recorded miracle here in the Bible now, right to the end of time. A mighty thing is done by the power of God for a widow woman who's now no longer in the ministry, you might say, doing her utmost now in circumstances of need to care for her sons and to watch over her home. So the power of God is for the most obscure Christian and lowly Christian and needy Christian. We look at life sometimes in the wrong way. Oh, there are the office bearers or the people with important jobs and this and that. And we come down and down and down, and someone may say, well, I'm relatively obscure. Yes, but all the power of God is available to you, just as to the most seemingly important person. And that's a great rule of the kingdom of God and a great encouragement to us all. And then remind you that the miracle is private. Great deeds are not enticements or inducements to lost people to seek the Lord for the wrong reasons. They're exclusive to his servants. Now, some of the great miracles that have preceded this in the ministry of Elijah as well as Elisha, they have been national deliverances or miracles to authenticate and attest the standing of a prophet or the power of God. But these private miracles are to the servants of God, and they are very largely the privilege and prerogative of the church. But it's very much like the miracle of Elijah in providing for the widow of Zarephath. And as I mentioned earlier, that's to show the handiwork of Christ. But it's a prophecy of Christ also. You learn about the Messiah. God pours his power through the prophet for a single individual. And that's exactly how Christ would act. He would always be working miracles for the poor and the needy. He didn't come as a political messiah to create a splendid kingdom. And he is saying in his work, I am the God of Elijah. I am the God of Elisha. Even in their miracles, they were prophets of me. They were showing what the work of Messiah would be like. Elisha, if you can do these things, why don't you do them to big, prominent public people and rock the nation? Why don't you use these mighty miracles to somehow impress the whole nation? No, again, it would be the wrong motive to encourage them to faith. That's not how God works. He's working with individuals to change hearts, to bless hearts, to provide for individuals. And Christ came exactly the same. Many of his miracles were public because he had to be authenticated. But most of the subjects were ordinary people, and they were illustrations of faith and believing and conversion. And so we see the same handiwork running through Elijah, Elisha, and other prophets to Jesus Christ in the kind of people who were most helped. But I'd like to come down to verse 8 and this remarkable dealing of God with the Shunammite woman. It fell on a day that Elisha passed to Shunem, where was a great woman, that is a very notable woman. Notable because her husband was obviously fairly wealthy and certainly has a farm and property and the capacity to enlarge his property and build on it. And she would appear to perhaps be a great cause for good in the locality. She was a great woman, she was of great reputation, but she was a woman of faith, it turns out. She constrained him to eat bread. It turns out he passed this way quite frequently. This was the road from Samaria to Carmel, and Elisha was constantly taking it, ministering at the school of the prophets in either place and in other places too. And she noticed this. And she insisted that he turned aside into her house to eat and to be helped. And so he turned in and he ate bread. But she constrained him. She insisted. She did not mind what others thought. They were against the prophets, the people generally. They didn't want to listen to them. They reproved them for their sin. They spoke against them. But this good lady, she didn't say to herself, I'll spoil my good standing and my reputation if I allow this Elisha, the prophet of prophets, to come into my house. She didn't mind if her reputation suffered because she wished to help him and identify with him. She didn't mind what they thought. She had to help the man of God. And this is a question which always enters in to the hearts of redeemed people. What can we do? Here there's a travelling prophet. What can we do? He has needs. I have the means. What am I doing? I must care for him. I must look after him. And that's the redeemed heart. And that's how we ought to be. Noticing needs, praying for people, helping where we can. And that's what this lady does. But it gets better and better. In verse 9, she said unto her husband, "Behold now, I perceive that this is an holy man of God." Well, she knew that, of course. What is meant here is that she's grasped from seeing Elisha at close quarters the depth of his earnestness and his heart and his godliness. And she realizes this is a great privilege. And he passes by continually. He's so often here. So here's her thoughtfulness, verse 10. "Let us make a little chamber." Well, it wasn't so little. It could house Elisha and Gehazi, his servant. It was constructed on the wall. It was obviously an extra story on the house, something like that. "And let us set for him there a bed, table, stool, candlestick." Why, if we're reading this in the wrong spirit, it might sound a little miserly, but it's the very opposite. She's got it all thought out. This is what we need to provide for him. Then why doesn't she say two tables, an extra wide bed, several candlesticks or lampstands? Why doesn't she go much further? Because he's a prophet. And she can see, in line with Elijah, Elisha is just the same. He's very frugal. Part of his standing and testimony is to proceed minimally. She's noticed all this. She says, "I know just what he needs and what he wants. He won't thank us for trying to make that chamber luxurious. He wants just the essentials of life." She'd got it perfectly planned. She was a woman of belief, being helpful, very understanding, very considerate. And so, verse 11, it fell on a day, he'd obviously been there many times already by now, that he came thither, and he turned into the chamber and lay there, and he said to Gehazi, verse 12, his servant, "Call the Shunammite." And when he had called her, she stood before him. He's going to do this through Gehazi. Even in those days, things must be properly done. This is a delicate matter. To reward the lady, there must not be any appearance at all of improper conduct on the part of Elisha. So he's with his servant, and he will take the message to the lady, and everything will be conducted through him. In other words, there'll be a witness. No one will be able to say ever in the history of subsequent time, "Oh, I've read 2 Kings chapter 4, and it sounds to me as though Elisha was doing some very shady and dubious things." No, another person is there. It's all very proper. How can we reward you? The suggestion made by Elisha surprises us at first. Verse 13, he said unto him, "Say now unto her, behold, thou hast been careful for us with all this care. What is to be done for thee? Wouldst thou be spoken for to the king?" Well, at this stage it would appear that Elisha has some standing with the king. Well, that's because of the defeat of the Moabites. He is in good standing, though he won't take advantage of it for himself, or to the captain of the host. There's some possibility, perhaps it was a reality, and Elisha knew about this, that this lady had been robbed, or wrongly treated, a miscarriage of justice in some way, by the authorities. "Would you like us to speak up for you, and to get wrongs put right?" Sounds as though there may have been something, but she wants no reward at all. She's content. She makes the reply that she dwells with her people. She's got everything she needs and could wish for, and everything is at peace. If there are wrongs, they don't need to be addressed. She'd rather leave them alone and not be contentious. And so in verse 14, after this interview has taken place, Elisha says to Gehazi, "What then is to be done for?" Now I believe that Elisha knows perfectly well what this lady needs, and he knows perfectly well what he's going to do for her. I don't think he needs Gehazi to make the comment that comes next. Gehazi answered, "Verily, she hath no child, and her husband is old." Now that was a dangerous position in that culture. She's got no heir for her husband, and that means if he's old and if he dies, then of course others inherit the property. Doesn't pass to her as the wife. No, not in that culture. And she would be very reduced. She's no son to keep everything in the family, and of course for her own happiness also. And no doubt Elisha knew that. He's kind of training Gehazi here. That's what prophets had to do. Those who were with them received a proper training. He's making Gehazi think and reflect, and he wants him to propose something that is really needed, to have noticed it. Actually, Gehazi turns out to be a very unworthy servant and assistant in due course, as you no doubt know. But I think that is what is going on. Elisha's a very sensitive man. Verse 15, he said, "Call her." And when he had called her, she stood in the door. The Bible is wonderful, the details it records. I think she said to herself, "I cannot come into this chamber. I don't want the prophet to think that I'm the owner of this, and I've not really given it to him for his use. I must stand at the door. It's his room. It's Elisha's room. It's given over to him. I shall respect it as though it were nothing to do with me." So she stands at the door. Don't you think that's what's going on? She extends every possible courtesy and care. When he had called her, she stood in the door, and he said, "About this season, according to the time of life, thou shalt embrace a son." What an emotive way of expressing it. Thou shalt embrace, you'll hold in your arms a son. Maybe we'd have expected Elisha to put that a little more delicately. You will have a son. Here's this lady, she's probably past longing and aching for a son now. She's accommodated to the fact that she'll be childless, and yet he puts it so emotively. You will put your arms around a boy. Now, if you make a statement like that as a prophet of God, that is a very solid promise. You will possess, you will have your own son to love and to cherish. That's in effect what he's saying. Not just you'll have a son, you'll embrace a son. Now that to this lady of faith meant that God, he's the prophet of God, is going to give her an heir. He's going to give her a son. I labour this point. You must understand this point. Because that's why when the son dies, she can't believe that he isn't going to be raised again. Because when she was promised the child, it was done in such an emotive way. You will hold and embrace and cherish and possess an heir and a boy. God can't go back on that. There must be a solution to the death of the son. So it's a very important word that Elisha uses. And she, "Well, don't mislead me," she says. "Nay, my lord, thou man of God, do not lie or mislead thine handmaid." She's frightened at the thought, how can it happen? And my husband is old. But then on the other hand, she knew there were others. There was Sarah. She'd had a child past age. There were others also, and this was in her head, no doubt. Verse 17, the woman conceived and bare a son at that season that Elisha had said unto her, according to the time of life, the time that it takes to have a son. And verse 18, when the child was grown, how old? Well, he's still quite small. He's being carried about and put on laps and things like that. So he's quite young, but he's old enough to walk a little distance and go out to the fields where his father is organizing the reapers in the reaping season. So what do you think? Doesn't matter really, but 8, 9, 10, something like that maybe, perhaps not much bigger. Verse 18, when the child was grown to at least that, it fell on a day that he went out to his father to the reapers, and he said unto his father, my head, my head. He thought the boy maybe had had sunstroke. He was in a state of collapse, yes, but it's just sunstroke. Some of the smart people today said he'd had a brain aneurysm. I don't know quite how they know, but it was at least sunstroke, but something quite severe. But the father misread it. Carry him, he said to his mother. Verse 20, when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. But she couldn't accept it, naturally. This had been promised by a prophet. She didn't want it, she didn't ask for it. And she knew she didn't deserve such a blessing for accommodating the man of God, but it was God who'd promised her a son. Couldn't be taken away. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, and shut the door upon him, and went out. Why did she do that? Well, because the man of God, he's the one who must resolve the problem. She must go to him. He was at Carmel, it turns out, 20 miles away. It was a long journey. But there mustn't be mourning. Her husband mustn't know, not yet. Why, if people in the household know, this was the way of the Jews, they will get the mourning process in motion immediately. So she shuts him into the prophet's room, which was an especially private place in the house. And she calls unto her husband, sends to him, verse 22, send me one of the young men, one of the asses, that I may run to the man of God, whatever for, he says in effect, in verse 23. Why would you go to him today? It's not a special festival, and it's certainly not the Sabbath day. And she said in their beautiful words, it shall be well. She's a woman of faith. This is just not an ordinary child. This is a child which has been given her by God and promised as an heir for her to possess. There must be a solution. So verse 24, she saddled an ass, said to her servant, drive as fast as you can. Don't slacken for me, unless I cry out in some way. And verse 25, she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel, 20-odd miles. The man of God saw her from a distance, told his servant, you know the narrative. Is it well with thee? Verse 26, is it well with thy husband? Is it well with the child? And she answers again, in effect, it is well. She's a woman of faith. And when she came to the man of God to the hill, she prostrated herself and held his feet. That's a mark of great pleading and faith and humility. And Gehazi thought she should be removed, but the man of God let her alone. He said, her soul is vexed within her, and the Lord hath hid it from me and hath not told me. They're very special words. God told the prophet so much. We have an insight into that. And then she says, verse 28, did I desire a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? Well, what's happening? Is grief now bursting through her faith so that there is an exclamation of woe and lament and complaint? Or is it, and I think this is more likely, an argument she pleads? She says in these words to Elisha the prophet, it cannot be that my boy should be taken, because he was given to me by you, by your word, by the Lord. And I said at the time, don't deceive me, the grief would be unimaginable if I had a child, or either failed to have a child, or had a child and the child died. It can't be. This is her argument. I believe this is from God. It cannot be. He can be taken. I don't think it's meant as a blurting out of a complaint. And he said, verse 29, to Gehazi, gird up thy loins. This is fascinating. Take my staff in thine hand. Go thy way. Don't stop to greet anybody. Don't answer anybody. You must get there as soon as possible. And lay my staff upon the face of the child. And off went Gehazi. And in the meantime, verse 30, the mother of the child said, "As the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth," she says to Elisha, "I will not leave thee." And he arose and followed her. She went first, he followed behind. Gehazi had gone on before them. He'd laid the staff, verse 31, upon the face of the child. There was no response, no voice, no hearing. And he thought this had failed. He didn't know why he'd been given the staff by Elisha. Why did Elisha do that? Did he think that Gehazi, by laying his staff upon the child, that would bring about the healing of the child? Was this a failing on the part of Elisha? No, not at all. Elisha no doubt knew perfectly well that the laying of a staff on the face of the child would not bring about his revival, his return to life. What Elisha was doing, and mainly I would think to console the woman, he was reserving the child for his attention. That laying of the prophet's staff upon the child was his way of saying, "I am coming. I will be there. This is in the hand of the Lord. Should anybody find the child?" Still, no funeral to be put in process, no mourning, no calling for the people who will wail and sorrow outside the room. The child is going to be raised. And so there's that token of expectation. And then, in due course, Elisha gets there himself. It's a 20-mile journey, as I've said several times. And verse 32, when Elisha was come into the house, behold, the child was dead and laid upon his bed. He went in therefore, shut the door upon them twain, that's himself and the child, and prayed unto the Lord. That's the main thing he did. He prayed. He called upon the Lord. Then he did something similar to that which Elijah had done previously. He lay upon the child, put his mouth upon his mouth, his eyes upon his eyes. He identified so closely with the child. He prayed the kind of prayer that longed and desired and felt for the situation. So even though I'm sure he knew the child would be raised up, he knew that he must labour in prayer for it. Oh, friends, how much we need to learn these lessons. You can't have God answer your prayers, not very much anyway, without strong desire, without identification with the lost people for whom you pray, without concern in your heart and longing. You may pray a good deal. You could pray an hour a day and never have much prayer answered if it's unconcerned prayer. This is a picture for us. He imitates Elijah. He identifies so closely and stretches himself out upon the child. We have to have hearts of desire and feeling and concern to have answers to our prayers. And even the prophet has to extend his activity in this respect. While at the end of verse 34, the flesh of the child waxed warm, he had an encouragement. The child still wasn't raised. And that happens to us. You pray for somebody. You take that person on your list of people for whom you intercede. And the person mellows, perhaps, listens to you more, hears the gospel, shows some signs of concern. The body is warming, but the person isn't converted yet, isn't even openly seeking yet. But what an encouragement that your prayer is answered at least in some measure. Pray on. And that's the picture we're getting here. There's an encouragement for Elisha. Verse 35, then he returned into the house and walked in the house to and fro, up and down, says the Hebrew. It's almost an agitated walk, but he's no doubt praying all the time. I think we're entitled to assume that. And then he went up into that upper chamber, and he repeatedly, he stretched himself upon him again, and then that wonderful sound, the child sneezed 7 times. What is the picture there? I don't know. Except that the child sneezed 7 times, and it was just a wonderful sound. A sneeze is not usually a wonderful thing to hear, is it? But it certainly was on this occasion. And the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, "Call this Shunammite." So he called her. And when she was come in unto him, he said, "Take up thy son." That's emotive too. He didn't say, "Pick him up." He said, "Take up thy son. Hold him in your arms. Your son, your heir that you possess, that you love, is returned to you." Then she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground and took up her son and went out. Well, it's a wonderful account. Faith is always tried. And I won't go beyond this point of the chapter, but I'll just make some applications in closing. Faith is always tried. Let's not say tested. That is not so full of meaning. Tried, not tested. Tried as silver is tried. The testing of faith, well, it's like an examination. You pass, you fail. It may not get you any further along the road of knowledge. But when you're tried, your faith is deepened and helped and you're added to, like the trying of silver, the refining of a precious metal. And faith is always tried, and my faith and your faith will be tried repeatedly, as we were saying on Sunday, in this coming year, so that it increases. Now the trying of her faith, and her faith held out nobly and beautifully all the way through. She believed this was from God. This was an heir. This was the size of the gift. But this kind of trial delivered her from perils. She was a wealthy woman. Her husband, though old, was still active. He was out directing the employees on the farm. They could afford to extend their home. They had the blessing of being able to minister to the prophet and do much good, and they were known in the area for it. And now, to crown it all, she had a son and an heir, given as a miracle from God. How likely it is for such a person to be carried away on a great bubble of delight. She's got everything running in her favour. Wealth, comfort, service, reputation, everything. And a trial will deliver her from the perils that all those things convey, so that she'd be less and less concerned for the things of the Lord, more and more spoiled by her comforts and delights. I'm not saying she was, but a trial would deliver her from the temptations of comfort and success. Oh, she'd come to so thank and praise God. She had been through the process of trusting him and clinging on to his goodness and his promises. How that would weld her more closely to the Lord. So you see, the trial was not a cruel test. It was something that would shape her and deepen her and help her to trust the Lord. And it would be a great assurance in her life. The Lord has done this for me. And that's what trials do to us also. So we must hold on, because they work for our good. The purpose of trials, and she, as it were, claimed the blessing and the promise of God. But there is implicitly, as we close here, also a typical Jewish prophecy of Messiah. A son will come. That's the great promise over the Jews, down the centuries, until the coming of Christ, all the way from the Garden of Eden, all the way through Abraham, through David, through the prophets, A son is coming, a great descendant through whom all the world will be blessed. And nothing will stop him from carrying out his purpose and walking this earth and suffering and dying for sinners and offering up his own righteousness for us to have eternity with him. Nothing will get in his way. The devil, we're told in the book of Revelation, will wait for his coming, watch and try to destroy the man-child, but he will not be taken away. And when he does go to Calvary, he'll rise again. And many, many times in the history of Judah and Israel, this preservation of the promised seed is pictured in different ways. And here is another little picture. She had a son promised, the son came, the son would survive. And it's all really a picture of what will happen through the Jews when Christ would certainly come. But overall, it's a miracle of God blessing and rewarding his people. You know what we read from the Lord Jesus Christ? That the person who ministers to the prophet and helps the prophet will get a prophet's reward. And that promise was active in the time of Elijah and Elisha. And here this woman is a tremendous example, the Shunammite. She helps the prophet, she feeds him, she houses him, and what a reward. It doesn't matter what our role in the kingdom of Christ, whether we're teaching, witnessing, helping, financing, supporting in some way, we get a prophet's reward. Everybody gets a reward on earth and an eternal reward in heaven. Because this woman, well, she didn't ask for it, she didn't expect it, she never dreamed of it, she was even frightened when the promise was made to her, lest it should be lost. But God dealt with her marvellously, and it's encouragement to every one of us. Whatever our trials, our setbacks, our difficulties, our disappointments, if you're serving the Lord will bless you. And in his way, and in a way that won't carry you away from him, but weld you more closely to him, he will reward you and compensate you and bless you. And these are the kind of things we read about through the miracles of both Elijah and Elisha. Let's close this evening singing the hymn 462.